Hello, beautiful people. This is your Fall 2021 AFM 491 podcast. My name is Sarah Oz. I'm your professor. Welcome to a new episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the episode about Chapter 1, Accounting for Investments. In this chapter, I will be briefly summarizing the key concepts we discussed in the chapter, and I will be asking you some easy true or false statements or some multiple choice questions. As I summarize the key concepts, I want to be very clear that this is not an exclusive summary. You still need to watch lecture videos and make sure that you understand everything that I discuss in the lecture videos. If I skip discussing something in the summary, it doesn't mean that it's less important. Further about the questions that I will be asking, since the purpose of this episode is to force you to review the chapter without necessarily using pen and paper, those questions are going to be relatively easy as well. Again, this is not an indication of what I might be asking on tests. The objective of this episode is to identify the key weaknesses that you may be facing when studying this chapter. Hopefully, this is going to be useful to you. And thank you for listening. After studying this chapter, you should be able to distinguish between the various types of equity investments measured at fair value. You should be able to prepare journal entries to account for investments under the cost and equity methods. You should be able to evaluate relevant factors to determine whether an investor has significant influence or full control over an investee. In this chapter, we covered equity investments. Equity investments are investments in shares of another company. There are two main categories of equity investments, strategic and non-strategic. For strategic investments, the investor intends to establish or maintain a long-term operating relationship with the entity in which the investment is made or has some level of influence over the strategic decisions of the investee company. The level of influence varies between full control, joint control, or significant influence. In this lecture, we cover the definition of full control and under which circumstances a company would have control over another company. We briefly discussed joint control as well, but I made a promise to discuss joint control in more detail in later chapters. For non-strategic investments, the investor is hoping for a reasonable rate of return without having the ability to play an active role in the strategic decisions of the investee company. We covered five different categories when it comes to equity investments. Under the strategic investments, we discuss three different types. One type of investment signals significant influence, in which case you would be using equity method to report these investments. Second one is that an investor company has full control over an investee company. In that case, reporting method would be full consolidation. And third one, there's joint control, and the reporting method would be equity method again. For strategic investments, reporting of unrealized gains and losses would be inapplicable. Then we discuss non-strategic investments, for which there are two different methods. Either you will be using fair value through profit or loss, or you will be using fair value through OCI. If you are using fair value through profit and loss, unrealized gains and losses would be in net income. For the method of fair value through OCI, unrealized gains and losses would be in other comprehensive income. Fair value through profit and loss investments include investments held for short-term trading. These investments are classified as current assets on the basis that they are actively traded and intended by management to be sold within 1 year. They are measured at fair value and subsequently measured at fair value at each reporting date. This means at each reporting date, you would be recording adjustment entries. This might lead to unrealized holding gains and losses, and these unrealized gains and losses would be reported in net income along with the dividends received or receivable. Fair value through OCI investments are equity investments that are not held for short-term trading, and those for which management, on initial acquisition, elects to report all unrealized holding gains and losses in OCI. These investments are classified as current or non-current assets. This depends on how long company managers intend to hold on to these shares. They are initially measured at fair value and subsequently remeasured at fair value at each reporting date. As you record the adjustment entries, unrealized gains and losses would be reported in OCI. Dividend income is reported in net income. The cumulative unrealized gains and losses are cleared out of accumulated OCI and transferred directly to retained earnings. This is also known as without recycling because it doesn't go through net income. The transfer to retained earnings would usually occur when the investment is sold or derecognized, but could be transferred at any time. When investments are not reported at fair value, they are usually reported using the cost method or the equity method. The cost method is very simple. Under the cost method, the investment is initially recorded at cost. The investor's share of the dividends declared is reported in net income. The investment is reported at original cost at each reporting date unless the investment becomes impaired. Therefore, there are no fair value adjustments. Impairment losses are reported in net income. An investment where the investor is able to significantly influence the operations of the investee is called an investment in an associate. These investments must be accounted for using the equity method. Equity method requires the investor to record its share of all increases in the shareholders' equity of the investee. Further, these recordings will be adjusted for the amortization of the acquisition differential and the holdback and realization of profits from the intercompany sale of assets. These are some concepts we haven't covered yet, and we will be discussing them in later chapters. In this chapter, we discuss how to determine whether a company has control or significant influence. The numerical threshold we discuss is that below 20% ownership, we tend to classify investments as non-strategic investments. Between 20% and 50% ownership, we tend to classify investments as associate investments, and we tend to arrive to the conclusion that there is significant influence. Above 50% ownership, we tend to arrive to the conclusion that there is full control, therefore that requires full consolidation. That being said, beyond numerical thresholds, there are some qualitative factors you need to be considering, such as representation on the board of directors or participation in policymaking process, or such as material transactions between the investor and the investee. We solved a bunch of case studies and some other problems from the textbook that should give you an idea about some qualitative factors to consider. When an investor has significant influence, the investment should be reported by the equity method. The basic concept behind the equity method is that the investor records its proportionate share of the associate's income as its own income and reduces the investment account by its share of the associate's dividends declared. Under the equity method, the investor's investment account changes in direct relation to the changes taking place in the investee's equity accounts. In other words, you are interested in net assets. The equity method reflects the accrual method of income measurement. As the investee earns income, the investor accrues its share of this income. The associate is not obligated to pay out this income as a dividend on an annual basis. Investments in associates are often classified as non-current assets. Hopefully, this summary is useful to you and this will help you to identify any weaknesses you may have. Now I will be asking you some simple questions from this chapter. Now I will be asking 8 questions about chapter 1. And some of these questions are multiple choice questions. Some of them are true and false statements. Let's get started with the first question. The first question is, if an investor's ownership interest in a significant influence investment increases or decreases, how are changes from accounting at fair value to the use of equity method or vice versa to be handled? I'll repeat the question. If an investor's ownership interest in a significant influence investment increases or decreases, how are changes from accounting at fair value to the use of equity method to be handled? A. Changes from the equity method are to be handled prospectively, while changes to the equity method are to be handled retroactively. B. Changes from the equity method are to be handled retroactively, while changes to the equity method are to be handled prospectively. C. Any change is to be handled retroactively. And D. Any change is to be handled prospectively. Essentially, the question is asking you how would you implement equity method changes? Prospectively, retroactively, or a combination of both? I'll give you a second to think about this. The answer is D. Any change is to be handled prospectively. Changes from and to the equity method need to be handled prospectively, meaning that you don't go back to restate the financial statements. You only apply this to the future. Question 2. If the investor sells part of its stake in an associate, accounted for using the equity method, which method is used to calculate the gain or loss on the sale of these shares? I'll repeat the question. If the investor sells part of its stake in an associate, accounted for using the equity method, which method is used to calculate the gain or loss on the sale of these shares? We solved a similar question in the lecture videos, so hopefully this is going to be obvious to you. A, you'll be using the average carrying amount of the investment. B, FIFO. C, LIFO. D, specific identification. The answer is A. I never once used the terms FIFO, LIFO, or specific identification when discussing chapter 1. So hopefully this answer should be very obvious. You're going to be using the average carrying amount of the investment. Question 3. If Posthorn Corporation accounts for its investment in STEM company at fair value through profit or loss, what entry will the company make to record the dividends received from STEM company? There's no mention of numbers. I'm not asking for any numbers. I'm just asking you to tell me the format of the journal entry. I'll repeat the question. If Posthorn Corporation accounts for its investment in STEM company at fair value through profit or loss, what entry will the company make to record the dividends received from STEM company?
J'imagine.
As you are thinking of the answers, I'm playing music to keep you entertained. The answer is you're going to debit cash and you're going to credit dividend income. The key thing to remember, whichever fair value method that you're using, dividends received will be recorded as income. So you debit cash, you credit dividend income. Fourth question. When a company has control over another company, a parent-subsidiary relationship is said to exist. Is the statement true or false? I'll repeat the question. I'll repeat the statement. When a company has control over another company, a parent-subsidiary relationship is said to exist. Is the statement true or false? The answer is this statement is true. If there's control, then we are looking at full consolidation, which means we have a parent and we have a subsidiary. Therefore, a parent-subsidiary relationship is set exists. Next question, the fifth question. How do joint ventures differ from private corporations? How do joint ventures differ from private corporations? A joint venture doesn't have a board of directors. B, there can only be two parties in a joint venture. C, ventures cannot make unilateral decisions. D, the ventures must share the risks and profits of the joint venture equally. I'll repeat the options. A joint venture doesn't have a board of directors. B, there can only be two parties in a joint venture. C, ventures cannot make unilateral decisions. And D, the ventures must share the risks and profits of the joint venture equally. The answer is C. Ventures cannot make unilateral decisions. A joint venture can have a board of directors, so the first one is not correct. There can be more than two parties in a joint venture, so the second statement is not correct either. And the last one, the ventures must share the risks and profits of the joint venture equally, that is not correct either. There can be a different kind of an agreement. But what is correct that in a joint venture, because the control is being shared, there has to be unanimous consent. So, which means ventures cannot make unilateral decisions. Question six. How are most significant influence investments in equity securities reported on the investors' financial statements? In other words, which accounting method should you be using to account for significant influence investments? A, using the equity method. B, using proportionate consolidation. C, using full consolidation. D, using the cost method. Hopefully, by now, the answer to this question is very much clear to everyone. The answer is equity method. If you are dealing with significant influence investments, you're going to be using equity method to account for it. Question seven. Walton Limited has the following shareholders. Sifter Corporation has 60% ownership. Folwell Corporation has 30% ownership. And Garni Limited has 10% ownership. Folwell, which has 30% ownership, does not conduct any business with Walton, nor has it been able to secure a seat on the board of directors. Is the following statement true? Folwell should treat Walton as a non-strategic investment. I'll repeat the question. Walton Limited has the following three shareholders. Sifter has 60% ownership. Folwell has 30% ownership and Garni has 10% ownership. Folwell, which has only 30% ownership, doesn't conduct any business with Walton, nor has it been able to secure a seat on the board of directors. Is the following statement true? Folwell should treat Walton as a non-strategic investment. The statement is true. The question is giving you two qualitative factors to indicate that Folwell doesn't have any material transactions with Walton, and they do not have any representation on the board of directors. The remaining shares sum up to 70%, meaning that the other two shareholders, especially Sifter, can easily take any decisions they want to take. This would imply that Folwell doesn't have any kind of influence on the on this Walton company. Therefore, Folwell should treat Walton as a non-strategic investment. And the last question. Is the following statement regarding structured entities true? Remember, it is about structured entities. These are either special purpose entities or variable interest entities. So again, the following statement is about structured entities, and I'm asking you whether it's true or false. As the company may not own shares of the entity, consolidation would not be required. I'll repeat the statement. As the company may not own shares of the entity, consolidation would not be required. And the answer to this question is false. With structured entities, there's no shareholdership. That being said, there's a contractual agreement which gives the sponsor full control. And once they have full control, consolidation is required. So therefore, the statement is false. This is the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. Hopefully this has been beneficial to those who are listening. Hopefully you enjoyed the summary and the questions. And then I'll see you at the next episode. Until then, be safe and keep accounting.